Today's Keitesho is on case 86 in the Hikigan Roku, the Blue Rock collection. Case 86 is entitled Umon's Everybody Has His Own Light. Engo's introduction. Controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thoughts, leaving not a drop behind. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced the barriers? See the following. Main subject. Umon spoke to his assembly and said, everybody has his own light. If he tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light? Later, in place of the disciples, he said, the halls and the gate. And again he said, blessed things cannot be better than nothing. Secho's verse, it illuminates itself, absolutely bright. It gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing. Non-seeing is seeing. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha hall. Again, I want to thank everybody for doing such an amazing job this morning, sitting very still through that long period. Really wonderful to see. People are really doing the work. You know, I mentioned earlier this student of mine who had really just gone on and on. He would come into Dogasan. I would say, what's happening with your koan? Nothing, you know. And this went on for years and years. And then I mentioned that, and finally he left after many years. And it was a mystery to me. And I mentioned that I was having lunch with a therapist friend of mine. And he was telling me about a situation with a patient of his, and I said, you know, that reminds me of somebody who used to be in our Zen group, you know, and he never talked to me. He'd come into Dogasan, and I'd ask him questions about what was happening. He'd say, nothing's happening, just blankness, and he said, well, your student didn't want to do the work. So, you know, everybody here is really doing the work. And that is so wonderful, so important. You know, it's really, you know, we have all been, in a way, conditioned not to do the work. You know, it's not just us. It's a mentality, you know, that is part of our culture. Not doing the work, not taking responsibility. We have a very top-down society, you know. I think a lot of us grow up feeling that other people control our lives and that we have very little control over our lives. You know, we follow the doings of political figures, and of course, they're very remote and very powerful. You know, with a stroke of the pen, they can change our lives. And you know, even in our recreation, you know, there's people like Tom Cruise and movie stars. You know, and you know, I think subtly. Very subtly, we get a message when we're growing up that life is like a pyramid, And at the top are the people who matter. And everybody else, you know, at the bottom of the pyramid, most of us don't really have any control over our lives. And I think that that has an effect on how we look at many different issues, right? We have a kind of a passivity about our many different things. You know, it's interesting. You know, when Zen came to China, you know, China was an empire. And the Chinese empire was a big pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid was, you know, the emperor. It's an empire, so you have an emperor. And his family lived eventually in the imperial compound in Beijing. And ordinary people like us, you know, if you sign up for a tour at the White House, you can actually go to the White House and you can walk in and you can look at the White House. But common people weren't even allowed to set foot in the imperial complex, which is why it's called the Forbidden City. Only like very high up people were allowed to even come in. And so, you know, basically you could see it, but you couldn't get in. And this is like a message too, right? You know, like the important people come in here and you're on the outside. And the people who ran China were these highly literate people called mandarins. And they wrote this very flowery language, very beautiful language. You know, it's interesting that Zen was always opposed to the mandarins. You know, if you look at the language of the Zen teachings in China, they're all written in colloquial Chinese, right? They're all written in kind of like conversational street Chinese. So it's, you know, when we read the koans, they seem a little nutty, but they're written in a very colloquial style. It's like, you know, they're written in English, it would be like, well, listen, guy, don't let them fuck with you, you know? That kind of thing, see? It doesn't always come across in the translations, but it's very salty and you know, guy on this person on the street type perspective, you know. So they were definitely, Zen was always like opposed to the power of the mandarins. And, you know, also, it was also opposed, you know, the mandarins said, you know, unless you've read all this stuff, you're an idiot. Unless you've read all the classics, you don't deserve to even be listened to. And so the mandarins were this very, very, like the 1%, you know, they were the 1% of China. And they had this vast knowledge and this flowery language, and they were very, they had good manners, you know. And you know, the heroes of Zen are people like Wei Nang, who was an illiterate woodcutter. And so, you know, the Zen tradition is sort of saying no to the Mandarin ideal, right? The Mandarin ideal is highly literate person who has steeped himself in the wisdom of the past. And Wei Nang was an illiterate woodcutter who had an insight into his fundamental nature, and so he became the founder, really the person who decisively shaped Zen in China. And also there were another group in China called the Taoists. If you have read the Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching, it's quite beautiful, or Chuanzi's writings. But you know, interestingly, the Taoists and the Zen has taken a lot, borrowed a lot from Taoism, but they actually have very different views. You know, if you read this great thinker, Chuanzi is his name, Chuanzi. You know, he says the heavenly man, there's a kind of person who learns to the ways of heaven, and he harmonizes himself with the spirit of heaven. And the heaven sort of like favors him, and he becomes a special person. They call it, it says, a heavenly man. So you know, basically, if you follow the Tao, if you cultivate the Tao, you become a heavenly man, a special person. And Chuanzang actually says, you know, heavenly people are not like ordinary people. You know, they, unlike ordinary people, they're semi-divine. And ordinary people live in darkness, and the Taoist sages are like divine men. And so, you know, basically the Confucianists said, you're not worth talking to unless you've imbibed the spirit of the ancestors. And the Taoists said, you have to harmonize yourself with heaven in order to be special. And so, you know, the Taoists spent their whole time trying to become immortal. They really believed that if they did the right, if I'm not criticizing Qigong or Tai Chi or anything like that. Those are wonderful practices. But in China, the Taoists began to practice Qigong and Tai Chi in order to become heavenly men. And they wanted to harmonize themselves with the energy of heaven in order to be special. And they spent a lot of their time, they thought if you really, really, really harmonized yourself with heaven, you would be virtually immortal. So basically the idea was to live for, become an immortal by practicing Tai Chi, drinking certain kinds of elixirs. They had many different practices. And so, you know, basically these two groups were all about how becoming special person, right? Better than others. You know, and so, you know, Zen actually and Buddhism in general have a very different approach, right? I mean, Zen basically Umon said to his assembly, everybody has his own light. See, that's actually a really very revolutionary thing to say, especially in China, where people were told, you know, you're just an ordinary person. You should be cultivating your energy, doing your energy work in order to become an immortal. Or, you know, you should be studying the classics in order to become a gentleman, a gentleman. But Yunmen says everybody has his own light. And this is, as they say, like really a revolutionary proposition. You know, in the West, you know, we also tend to think of the universe as a hierarchy, you know, often. So, you know, there's a, you know, basically people talk about God in heaven. God in heaven. So you know, God is in heaven and we're down here. Basically, we understand that a great religious teacher might be the light. You know, I am the light, right? But it would be revolutionary in our culture to say, well, all people are the light. All of us are the light. So it's actually kind of a revolutionary claim here too. You know, the Buddha actually said this too. You know, the Buddha actually, just before he died, he said the verses we recite every morning. Atta dipa. Atta dipa. That means, that can be translated two different ways. One is, atta dipa can mean, you are an island. You're an island. Or be an island, see? And it can also be translated as, you are the light. The word dipa can mean island or it can mean light. And this is not a contradiction, really. The Buddha is saying, the light is in you. You are the light, see? So right from the start, you know, the Buddha lived in a period when people believed in high heavenly gods like Indra. Buddha said, the gods, they may exist, but they can't help you. Actually, the Buddha said the gods can't have enlightenment. He said the gods can't really have enlightenment. They are trapped in their eternal natures, and they can't change. Only embodied humans can become enlightened because of their capacity to change. Basically, this is like a really revolutionary teaching. In other times, the Buddha might have been killed for saying such a thing. But he said, don't bother with the gods. Don't bother with trying to please the gods. You know, that's childish. Who cares what they think? Your freedom is, you are the light, see? You know, if you read Greek myths, you know, they're so interesting because everybody's always trying to please the gods and get the gods on their side. In Greek classics, you know, basically one city is loved by Athena and the other city is loved by Zeus, worships Zeus, right? And so, you know, if the people who worship Zeus attack Athena, up in heaven, Zeus and Athena have a big argument, right? And they actually use humans against each other. So, you know, Athena will get back at Zeus by sending a fleet to attack his favorite city. And, you know, so this is like madness, right? This is a silly view of things. But it's, I think, you know, we all have sort of taken in this way. We live in a culture that's not so different from this way of thinking. You know, in our culture, you know, as in ancient China, you know, we look for the top person, you know. If somebody has a complaint in the English department, you know, if a student has a complaint, they'll come to my office and they'll say, who's in charge here, right? Take me to the top guy, right? And it's like, you don't matter. And are you the department chair? And I'm actually not the department chair. I run a division, basically. And I say, well, I'm the division head, but the department head, the department chair is down there. Well, you know, screw you. I'm going to the top, you know. You're just a peon, you know. But what does that say about how that person thinks of himself or herself? Because I assume that person is not at the top, right? So it's like you aren't worthy of respect means I'm not worthy of respect either. We really think this way. You know, we feel so insecure about ourselves. You know, there's a lot of hero worship in our culture. You know, that we take that in and it creates, I think, a kind of passivity. Or, you know, people become very competitive about getting close to those who are at the top. You know, getting close. You see that even in religious organizations, right? Where, you know, people work very hard to get to be, you know, to in, get to be, ingratiate themselves with like the, you know, the bishop or something, or the rabbi or something, because, you know, then you're getting a little closer to the top, you know. So you see that in Zen too. You see that in Buddhist communities too. You know, I mean, I love the Dalai Lama. I love him. But I love him because he gets up every day and does 4 hours of meditation, and he has worked on himself for you know, 70 years, since he was like a little kid, he's been doing meditation. So I revere the Dalai Lama, but you know, there's lots of people who revere the Dalai Lama because he's the Dalai Lama. And it's just that the Dalai Lama, you know, and there's a kind, so I want to be near or around somebody who's powerful and charismatic. And maybe some of that will rub off on me, see. And we, this is a habit of that's deeply ingrained in all of us, right? And that one side pushes us to like compete against everybody else to get to the top or close to the top. And the other, and that goes hand in hand with like contempt for ourselves and contempt for other people. You know, I have definitely been in Zen communities where, you know, there's like an inner circle around the teacher, and then everybody else is sort of in the outer circle. This is so unhealthy. But it's not, you know, and it's very contradictory to the spirit of Zen. You know, when I first met my first teacher, Genki Roshi, he was mopping a floor. You know, this is the master, you know, and he's mopping the floor. That was a real wonderful moment for me. I thought, I'd love to study with this guy, you know. And I'm glad I did, you know. So anyway, there's something really revolutionary about the claim that we get up every morning, we say, Atta Deepa, you are the light. You are the light. So, you know, we don't necessarily treat ourselves like the light. And we don't necessarily treat other people like they are the light, you know. I mean, I don't too, you know. So it's a very important part of our cultivating practice. You know, when we begin to do the work, this is really good for us because we're taking ourselves not too seriously, but we're treating ourselves with respect, right? It's like you are a Buddha in process, right? And if for most people, that just sounds like science fiction. And people tend to be very harsh and judgmental on themselves, but the basic Buddhist teaching is you are a Buddha in training, a Buddha in process. You know, we don't basically mostly believe in our inherent wisdom. You know, innate wisdom. We don't believe that. It sounds nice, right? But I've made too many mistakes in my life. You know, I wanted to do this and I did it, and then, you know, and then I, you know, realized I'd made a mistake. So how can I trust myself? So when we don't trust ourselves, we tend to look to people in authority or to powerful figures, and we say, well, they must have figured it out, you know. So what we're doing is really like deconditioning ourselves. You know, to come to Sesshin is like acting like a Buddha. This is just, if you have pain in your legs, it's day three for you. You know, you have pain in your legs, welcome to the path of the Buddhas. You know, that's for the Buddha. The Buddha had pain in his legs just like you. You know, the Buddha said, you know, basically, nobody can transfer enlightenment to you. So in Buddhism, there's nothing where somebody can come up to you and say, I take away your karmic debts, you're freed, right? It's like, no, you have to work it through. There's nobody who can take away your karmic debts for you through some mysterious process. And the Buddha didn't say, if you believe in me, you will be saved. What the Buddha said was, follow my path, see? Roll up your sleeves, get on the cushion, and start practicing meditation. And if you do that, you will be liberated. So follow my path. And the Buddha specifically, you know, there was a very, in one of the sutras, towards the end of the Buddha's life, one of his disciples said to him, I think it was Shariputra. Shariputra said, you know, Lord Shakyamuni, I don't think there's ever been and there will ever be another person like you in all of time. He said, you know, I don't think there will ever be another being as enlightened as you, even if many avatars should appear. I don't think, the Buddha said, cut the crap. He said, cut it out. He does. He doesn't say crap, but he basically says, basically Shariputra says, you know, Buddha, there's never going to be another enlightened person like you, ever. And the Buddha said, Shariputra, have you met any of these people? And Shariputra says, no. And he says, well, how do you know, if they're like as good as I am or not? He said, so the point is not me. You know, the point is the path, right? So that's such a good, that's so different, I think, from so many religious teachers who say it's me, it's all about me. You know, even in devotional Buddhism, you know, people, there's devotional Buddhism, which is big in China, or was at one time, called Pure Land. But, you know, even those people practice. You know, Pure Land Buddhists do practice. They recite, they recite often in a kneeling position, lines from the sutra over and over and over and over again until they go into samadhi. So you know, there are saving Buddhas like Amida, but you have to do the work. You still have to do the work. Amida just says, if you do the work, you're going to be okay. You could be enlightened. You know, so this is really revolutionary teaching. You are the light. And when you sit on the cushion and your legs hurt and you're getting tired and you feel like crying, or you cry, or, you know, you think, what the hell am I doing here? Where are my car keys? You know, you're actually honoring yourself. You are treating yourself like the Buddha you really are. You're taking yourself seriously as a Buddha. And that, as I say, don't take yourself too seriously. But it's definitely important to honor yourself in this way. You're saying, I have the capacity to wake up just like the Buddha, even I. You know, and that, I think, is 100% true. You know, that's the message of the Buddha. You can do it. You can do it. You say, oh, me? Who the hell am I? You know, I'm not Tom Cruise. You know, there's even celebrity Buddhists, right? You know, you say, well, I'm not Richard Gere. Who am I? You know, to be, you know, but. But the truth is, the Buddhist message is everybody is a Buddha. And when you come to Sesshin, you're treating yourself like the Buddha you really are. You're following the Buddha's path. You're sitting down on the cushion. It's part of our unhealthy mentality to assume that it was easier for the Buddha because he was a special person. See, that's that special person mentality. Yet the Buddha was a special person in a certain way. You know, we're told in Buddhist mythology that he had lived many, many lives impeccably, morally impeccably. In order to be reborn as the Buddha, he had to live lives of service to humanity over and over again. So he definitely had the spirit of service to humanity. Selfless service, right? All the same, you know, he wasn't born divine, right? He wasn't born a divine. You know, he had to work for it. He had to do the work. It's hard for people in our culture to get around this because, you know, if you saw The Matrix, for example, you know, there's a guy named Neo, right? And Neo is just like an ordinary computer guy, but it turns out he's the one, right? And so people say, Neo, you are special. You're the one. It's like, well, that's a fantasy, right, of specialness. Now look, Neo didn't do anything special, right? He just turns out to be the one. Well, the Buddhist teaching is you're all the one. We're all the one. But you have to work for it. Yeah? And that means sitting on the cushion and, you know, sometimes I've gotten off the cushion and my cushion is wet, right, from sweating, especially in August, you know. But it's part of it's the heat, but part of it's just I'm working so damn hard, you know. As I mentioned earlier in the session, you know, everybody wants to talk about, there's a famous Zen saying, everybody wants to talk about, you know, the Joshus and the Rinzais. Nobody wants to talk about the sweating horses of the past. In other words, you know, we have to work hard to wake up. You know, to be a Joshu, you know, Joshu sat just like you are on his cushion on day 3 of session, and his legs hurt like hell, you know? Just like you. And so you can't sort of like cop out by saying, I don't know if people still use that word cop out. That's a cop. In the 70s, a rationalization we called a cop out. You can't rationalize by saying, oh, well, I'm no Joshu, I'm no Linji. You are, if you want to be. You know, so you know, please remind yourself, this is painful, but it was painful for the Buddha too. He had legs just like me, right? In our Zen community, when I was training, we used to recite the great vow, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. And after session, we'd all be driving home in a car, and we used to say, the great way is not difficult for those who have no legs. And that got a laugh to anybody who's done Zazen, right? So the Buddha, too, had pain in his legs. He, too, worked through his obstacles. You know, the Buddha worked really hard. You know, he tried every damn thing to wake up. And he had to work through all his obstacles just like us. And there's nothing special about the Buddha except that he did it. And we can follow his example. In the Buddhist view, there are no divine beings. There's nobody who gets it on a silver platter in the whole universe. And in fact, you know, even though it's true that Tibetan Buddhists believe in the Dalai Lama is reincarnated and so on, you know, he's been doing Zazen since. The Dalai Lama in his memoir said he used to have to meditate and then he used to have to study the sutras when he was like 10. And he had a telescope in his room and he'd look out at all the little kids playing and he'd think, oh, I want to go out and play. Right? So very heartbreaking, right? But then he had the spirit of selfless service to mankind. And so he became awake to fulfill his opportunity to help others. See? So, you know, you are the light. And being the light doesn't mean you sit down on the cushion and you know, enlightenment. See, that's the fantasy, right? There was a guy when I was young who started something called he changed his name to Werner Erhard because it sounded like Meister Eckhart, the great mystic, medieval mystic. So he invented a new name for himself. And he said, I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge in my convertible, and it hit me, the universe, right? And then he made quite a nice living doing workshops and things like that. It doesn't work that way. You know, that's not how it works. You are the light, but, you know, we all have, it's a gem that's buried in a lot of the things that we have to clear away, right? He probably was kidding himself, and he was definitely fleecing a lot of people in the Bay Area for a long time. It's here for you. It doesn't require anything more than your cushion. You know, 3 meals a day, this community, this wonderful, wonderful community of like-minded people, and everything is possible. You know? But there's one more part of this koan that we shouldn't miss. Uman said to his assembly, Uman spoke to his assembly and said, everybody has his own light if he tries to see it. But then he adds, if he tries to see it, everything is darkness. You see, that is so important. The art of Zen practice, you can't just sit on the cushion and visualize light. That's just pure BS, right? That doesn't produce enlightenment. If only, right? You have to be open to your innate wisdom. When you sit down on the cushion and try to imagine light in order to become enlightened, that is your small self strategy, right? That's a kind of a conniving mind thinking, oh, this is the easy way. You know, you have to open yourself up to the mysterious workings of your innate wisdom. And your innate wisdom isn't your machine. It doesn't do what you tell it to do, right? It has purposes beyond your understanding. So, you can't say to your innate wisdom, answer my call. See? That's a magical thinking again, right? That's we're thinking of a being. Now we've put our innate wisdom up in heaven again. Please, innate wisdom, answer my call for me. That is a deeply ingrained habit. But what we have to do is get out of our way. So mushin, cultivating the mind of emptiness, see. My second teacher, Webb, used to call this making ourselves small. He used to say, get out of your own way. Make yourself small. But you have to die on the cushion. You have to face the wall of emptiness. And then you begin to cultivate the openness of receptivity and humility to be the instrument of your big mind, of your innate wisdom. And so, you know, the innate wisdom has its own purposes. It has a bigger plan than you do. And so it doesn't obey your commands. It drags you sometimes in a direction you don't. You know, the reason people can't answer their koan is because they think the koan is taking the koan. They want to go west. The koan is clearly pointing west, and then they try to go west and they can't go, and they try to go west and they can't go. When the koan is really pulling them east, when their innate wisdom is really pulling them east. So the small mind says west. And the big mind says east. And we can't answer our koan until we give up and go, okay, you win, east, see. That's what has to happen on the cushion again and again in order for us to wake up. Okay, you win, I give up. We'll go east, okay. And then, lo and behold, something wonderful happens. If you try to see it, it appears when you try but let go. See, in Zen you have to try but let go. If you don't try, nothing happens. If you don't sit down on the cushion, you don't focus on your koan, nothing. If you don't do the work. But even if you do those things, you can't control, you can't make it happen. You just have to be receptive. You have to be receptive. It's like going up on a mountain and waiting for lightning to strike, right? You know, every day you go up, it doesn't strike every day. But one day it strikes, you know. Okay. So you just, if you're not on the mountaintop, you don't see the lightning strike. So you've just got to faithfully, obediently to yourself, And respecting yourself, you're going up to the top of the mountain and you're waiting for the lightning to strike. And then it strikes, right? When you, maybe sometimes when you least expect it, and it doesn't strike in the way you expect or the way you imagined. And if you have an insight, if something happens to you on the cushion, and then you try to go back to that again, you screw everything up. You know, I talked about the fact that there was a person in our group who's now back in China, and one time he came in and he said, "I can't believe it. You know, everything the old master said about qi energy is true. You know, there's electricity flowing down my arms through my fingers." And I said, "That's great. You know, excellent. You know, you're in really deep samadhi. Right now, samadhi is taking that form." And then the next day, he came in and he was so dejected. And he said, "You know, so I can't make the electricity come back." You know? It's like, no, don't make it come back. You know, it has its own mysterious ways. Just empty yourself out again, and it will present itself as a new experience. It's new every time. See, I mean, I have been sitting for 40 years. I love it. It's always interesting. You know, my job is to empty myself out on the cushion and just wait for lightning to strike. But it's always fresh. It's always something new. You know, if I sat there saying, "Okay, this is here's what I want to have happen," I'm going to have a lousy sit, you know. It's always fresh if you're open to what's happening. Engo's introduction. Controlling the world, he allows not the least speck of dust to escape. He cuts off the diluted stream of thought, leaving not a drop behind. If you open your mouth, you are mistaken. If you doubt for a moment, you have missed the way. Tell me, what is the eye that has pierced the barriers? See the following. Main subject, Umon spoke to his assembly and said, "Everybody has her own light. If she tries to see it, everything is darkness. What is everybody's light?" So nobody can answer. Nobody answers. He says, "What does that mean?" Nobody answers. So they are not there yet. So he answers. And he says, "The halls and the gate." And again he says, blessing things cannot be better than nothing. Whatever beautiful thing happens can't be better than Mu, because Mu is the gate to awakening. Setchel's verse, it illuminates that you don't control yourself. You don't control your innate wisdom. It illuminates itself, absolutely bright. He gives a clue to the secret. Flowers have fallen, trees give no shade. Who does not see if he looks? Seeing is non-seeing, Mu. Non-seeing is seeing. See, this is so great, right? How do we get to enlightenment? It's like we're riding backward on the ox. See? The ox is going towards enlightenment, but all we ever see is we're looking back. See? We don't control it, you know? The ox is carrying it. We're going forward, forward. And the ox is going in the other direction. No, wait. Turn around, right? But it's going towards enlightenment. Facing backward on the ox, he rides into the Buddha hall.